This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
BBC Sounds.
Hello, Lucy White here from BBC Scotland's Podlitico. We'll let you get back to Scotland Outdoors in just a moment, but first I want to tell you about our podcast. We're a team of political journalists who like to unpick what's actually happening at the Scottish Parliament and Westminster. We look at all these political decisions and what they mean for you and me, and we try not to take ourselves too seriously. We have a new episode every Thursday at 6 p.m. Subscribe to Podlitical on BBC Sounds. Now back to Scotland Outdoors.
The Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, and with me today is Helen Needham.
And isn't it such a glorious day today, Mark? It's one of those perfect winter days. There's frost still on the ground. I live in a bit of a frost pocket on the farm here, and I've been out dealing with chickens and having to de-ice their water and things like that, but with a kind of pleasure, actually, in doing that. Yeah. How about you?
Well, again, out doing the horses this morning, and just drawn out of the stables at one stage by the sound of the geese going over. They basically move from the Lochstrath Beg down onto Loch Skeen, and they overfly us. It happens just about every day, twice a day, as a matter of fact. And coming out just at the point where the sun was crossing the ridge, and you could see the sunlight reflected under the wings. So it was, you know, just beautiful, a really nice sound and a nice moment and a nice thing to see. Our guest today is Ray Wynne. Now, Ray grew up in rural England, met the love of a life, Moth, when they were still teenagers. And they ended up settling in Wales and bringing up a family in fairly idyllic surroundings. But a few years ago, their world collapsed. They were made homeless. And more or less at the same time, Moth was diagnosed with a terminal illness. Now, this prompted them to go for a walk, rather a long walk, along the southwest coastal path in England, 630 miles on foot. They slept in a tent, and as far as I can work out, seemed to survive on packet noodles for quite a long time because they barely had 2 pennies to rub together. Rayner wrote an account of this journey called The Salt Path, which quite rightly, to my mind, became a bestseller. She's recently published another book called The Wild Silence, which continues their remarkable story and tells how the natural world has provided healing for both of them. Now, Ray joins us from her home in Cornwall. How are you? Give us a sense of your surroundings.
Oh, hi. Lovely to be with you this morning. I'm on a farm in Cornwall at the moment. It's in a beautiful little wooded valley that feeds down to a creek. It's a creek that's supposed to have inspired the writing of Winding Willows, but I'm not sure whether I believe that or not. But it's a beautiful spot, and it's full of birds this morning. It's full of buzzards flying over and a lot of very squabbly sparrows this morning. But it's grey here. We don't have any frost today. We've had frost in the last couple of days, but this morning it's just one of those grey, sort of slightly damp Cornish mornings.
We'll come back to how you ended up on your Cornish farm a bit later, but let me take you back to your childhood. You grew up on a farm, which was part of an estate. You loved to spend time alone in the woods. What was your childhood like?
It was very, very rural. It was a farm that was quite isolated from neighbours, so I didn't grow up with lots of people around me. And I spent more time with the dog, I think, than I did with other children. You two both obviously know about farms. They're quite busy places and there's not a lot of time for children and playing. So I spent a lot of time on my own, wandering around the fields and into the woods and time just basically being in nature. And that's how I grew up. Most of my time watching rabbits or scrambling through the ditches, stalking water voles.
You write about returning to that place when you go back to be with your mother who's dying, and you find it to be a very different place from when you grew up.
I did. I remember as a child there, the place was full of wildlife. Rabbits. The place was just completely covered in rabbits, which I used to have a thing when I was a child. I would go and just stand and clap my hands and just watch the field just sort of move like a brown wave down the rabbit holes. But also it was in the woods. In the woods, there was all sorts of bird life in the woods, and foxes, badgers, so many things going on in the woods. And I went back to that farm and that landscape of my childhood, and sort of visually, most of it seemed the same. But then the more time I spent there, I realised it just wasn't the same at all, that something had changed. And that's where the feeling of the title of my second book, Wild Silence, that's where it came from. That sense of actually the landscape had gone quiet, that so much of the wildlife of my childhood just wasn't there anymore. It had been almost sanitised somehow, just changed.
Well, would you mind reading from that section of the book for us?
As night turned into morning and the hospital day began, I started to understand what it was that didn't feel quite the same about the fields and woods of the estate. What it was that had changed in such a silent way that its passing was hardly noticeable. There was a lack of something, but that lack had been almost invisible until I held up the mirror of Copsford, and what was reflected wasn't the estate of my childhood. I looked up from the book at the leafless branches of the birch tree outside. Of course the hedges weren't full of wildflowers or the grass buzzing with bees. It was the end of January. But it was something less obvious, something more than the converted sawmill and the commuters living in the farm workers' cottages. It was a stillness, a wild silence beyond the emptiness of the pine trees, a silence on the wind, the deadness of something having gone. The farm had become a different, neater, more barren place. The wild things had gone. The skies were quieter, and the earth was empty and dark. An invisible change, almost imperceptible, until it shone out in Copsford's blinding light.
See, that's interesting, because I think what you are seeing there, you know, what you're noting, is actually quite common throughout the country, which is kind of like the sanitisation of the countryside. You know, we're taking big chunks of the countryside and turning it into garden, essentially.
I think we are, actually. I think we're taking away the wild corners and the wildness, and farming has cleaned the countryside. It's neatened it, it's smartened it, but in doing that, we've taken away so much habitat, and the wildlife has gone with the messy hedgerows. It's gone with the weed killer in the fields, and I think we've got to find a way to get that back.
You met the love of your life, Moth, when you were both quite young, and you actually came to Scotland to seek adventure in the hills together, and a particularly memorable camping trip up in the far northwest.
Oh, we did, yeah, absolutely. That was our first holiday together, the very first time I'd been away with Moth. My parents thought that I was going away with his parents and staying in a B&B, but really I'd just borrowed a rucksack from his friend, and we headed up north of Ullapool, we were going to climb a mountain called... Now, sorry about my pronunciation, but I've always thought of it as Ben Mor Coigach.
That'll do. Close enough.
Close enough. Thank you. And so we headed north and set off. It was a beautiful, beautiful summer's day. One of those days where the air is sort of like hanging really heavy over the heather and it's just completely still. It's just you and the midges. And we set off and there was no water, there was nothing. There was just dried peat bogs up towards the foot of Sgur an Fidgler, which I'm probably also pronouncing it wrong, the Fidgler anyway. And there was a little lochan at the bottom of that mountain called, I think it was Lochan Tuath. And we camped there and it was absolutely incredible. We were alone, just us in the mountains. We heard this sort of sound. It sounded like singing in the hills. And we went out of the tent to see what it was, and it was deer just running down off the mountainside and heading downhill. We knew why later in the night. When I woke up, it was about 2 a.m, there was this noise, sounded like it was like a steam train coming up the valley, and it got louder and louder and louder, and then it hit the tent with the force of a steam train. And we were in this tiny little tent, Moth with his feet, size 12 feet, up against the tent pole, trying to hold it up because it had just one pole. But then the pole snapped. And we were just wrapped in a cocoon of soggy, wet nylon. So we got out of that and got out a survival bag. Well, Moth told me it was a survival bag. To me, it was just a big orange plastic bag. And we got into that gradually filled up with water as the tent that we just got out of spiralled away over the mountainside into the darkness. And we lay in this plastic bag on the side of a mountain, just watching the most tremendous storm, a storm like nothing I've ever seen before. It was, the water was coming down, it was coming up, it seemed to be forming balls of water in the air. I've just never seen anything like it in my life. And we just lay there for hours in that plastic bag as it got deeper and deeper in water inside the bag until there was a sort of crack of light in the morning. And we got out of the bag, absolutely drenched to the skin, miles up the side of a mountain, to find that what had been dried peat bogs up till then was now just rivers and lakes and soggy bogs of water. And we had to find our way down. I think from what had been just a fantastic relationship, it turned into something else in that night, something really connected to nature at that point.
I often wonder if that kind of intensity of experience, because I mean, obviously we're talking years and years and years ago, and it's still very, very fresh in your mind, actually somehow cements, it can break some relationships. I mean, so, some folk thinking, stuff this for a game of soldiers, I'm not putting up with this. But it really cements other relationships, and obviously it did in your case.
Absolutely. I mean, it was our first holiday together. We could have been on a beach somewhere in the heat, but we were in a plastic bag. And could have driven many relationships apart, I think, that night. But it didn't. It really cemented ours. And like you say, stayed so immediate in my memory. I think about it now and I can be there. I can smell the plastic and see the storm. So, yeah, they really do imprint themselves on your memory, moments like that, I think.
You got married in Portree on Skye, didn't you? And then you ended up settling in Wales on a farm and bringing up your children. Tell us a bit about the Wales experience and where you were and the kind of environment you were in.
When we first met, you know, I was a teenager when I first met Moth, but in the years that followed that, we'd sort of had this dream that we would find somewhere in the hills a ruin that needed restoring and make that into a home where we could live the sort of life that we dreamt of living. And I think I was about 30 when we did actually finally find that home. And it absolutely was a ruin. There was holes in the walls and the roof was caving in. But it was everything that we dreamt of. And so we spent the next 20 years of our life restoring the property, converting an old barn into a holiday let so visitors could come and stay and share that amazing lifestyle we created. It was a place that was full of wildlife, where we kept sheep and we grew vegetables, and our children grew up and then left for university. It was our dream home and the idyllic life that we'd planned to have.
It does sound very idyllic, but almost in the blink of an eye, it went horribly wrong. Explain how.
In the background of those years there, we'd had this financial dispute with a lifetime friend that went sadly very wrong and ended in a court case. And the court case spun on for quite some time, but then eventually didn't go our way, and we were served with an eviction notice from our home. That place that we'd lived in for 20 years and put all of our time and our effort and our money into. It had become a whole life. It wasn't just our life, it was our business as well. It was our main source of income. So when we were served with that eviction notice, it wasn't just from our house, it was almost evicting us from our life.
And simultaneous to that, Moth gets a really serious diagnosis.
Yeah, so we were given a week to leave the property. So it was in that awful week of trying to pack 20 years of life into boxes that Moth had what we thought was going to be just a routine hospital appointment, where we thought he'd damaged his shoulder some time earlier when he'd fallen through the barn roof when we were repairing it. And we really expected them to say that it was ligament damage that could be fixed. So we really weren't thinking about what the outcome of that appointment when we went to the hospital. But it was anything but a routine day, because he was given a diagnosis of an illness that has no treatment, no cure. It was a neurodegenerative disease called corticobasal degeneration, something we'd never heard of. And it's quite, maybe if not rare, then certainly uncommon. And we were absolutely in shock when we got that diagnosis. Something that we absolutely had not thought of for one moment could be the outcome of that day. And then to be told that there was absolutely nothing that could be done. And the best recommendation that the consultant could give us was that Moth should just try not to get too tired and be careful on the stairs.
It was such an eye-opener reading your first book, The Salt Path. I think actually I read it in two sittings because it was just so compelling. You find yourself in that dreadful situation with nowhere to live, no money, deeply unwell husband, but you choose to undertake a 600-mile walk. Tell us about the Southwest Path.
Yeah, it's maybe not the most responsible or reasonable response to that week, is it? But we decided to walk the Southwest Coast Path, really, from the moment we were about to leave the house, when the bailiffs were knocking at the door and we were hiding under the stairs just because we weren't ready to take that step out of the doorway. And I spotted a book in a packing case by Mark Warrington. It was called 500 Mile Walkies, a story about a young man that walked the Southwest Coast Path that follows the whole of the coastline of the southwest of England with his dog. And it just seemed like the most obvious thing to do, just fill a rucksack and go for a walk. But I think we didn't realise at that point that actually it's 630 miles, not 500.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but it's as if that's going to make a big difference, that extra 130 miles.
Yeah, it was 630 miles, but I think the thing we didn't realise was that it has an ascent that's equivalent to climbing Everest nearly four times. When we read Coast Path, I think we thought it just more or less followed the beach, but it turned out to be really one of the most difficult paths in the country, that is constantly down to sea level, back up to a few hundred feet, back down to sea level. It's just a remorseless path over headlands and beaches and through woodlands and coombs. It goes all the way from Minehead in Somerset through the north of Devon, round the whole coastline of Cornwall, South Devon, and then ends in Poole in Dorset. So quite an epic walk, really.
And the constant presence of the sea as well. You actually write about how you two became salted.
That's right. I mean, there is something incredible about that path. I mean, it might not be the Highlands of Scotland. It might not have that absolute remote wildness of Scotland, but there is something incredibly wild about the path. You've got this sort of ordinary everyday world on one side, but then the sea constantly, that endless horizon of the sea on the other side, always. It's a strip of wilderness, really, that's apart from that ordinary, well, not ordinary, but the normal, what you think of as the southwest, of a place of holidays and beaches and caravan parks. It's sort of apart from that, and it's as if the wildlife of the area has been driven and concentrated into this strip of wilderness that follows the coast. And it is like a world apart.
So I think that the proper scientific term for the area on the coast, the sort of intertidal zone, is the liminal zone. And that's kind of the reality of the existence you were entering. It's extraordinary. But bearing in mind that the advice you had been given by the medical profession, or for what Moth had been given, was try not to get too tired and be careful on the stairs. Taking this path was really quite a leap, but it helped. It helped him.
Yeah, when you're told to be careful on the stairs, you don't do the coast path, do you? But liminal, I quite like the idea of that as a piece of land, because that's how we were living. We were living maybe in a liminal zone of life. I don't know. It was like that. But Moth's health was really, it was just a real problem at the start, because he was struggling to get in and out of the tent. He was struggling to put his rucksack on without being in pain. Weeks later, maybe 200 miles later, we started to notice that his walking was just a little bit more stable, that his thinking was just a bit clearer. And I think we really knew that something was changing. At the end of what had been sort of a perfect summer's day, where there'd not been a breath of wind, and we went down to this little cove, Porthos Cove, and the sea was just like so flat, it was like treacle. We went out, we swam in the bay, and there were dolphins in the bay, and it was just like, if we hadn't been homeless and Moth was ill, then it would have been a perfect day. We pitched a tent at the very edge of the beach, way above the high tide line, and thought we were going to have a beautiful night there. Until about 3 o'clock in the morning, we did. But then at 3 in the morning, I opened the tent flaps to find that the tide that we thought we were way beyond the high tide line was actually only a metre from the tent, and it was still rising. So we had to jump out of the tent and grab everything that we could. And we picked the tent up whole, still fully erected, and ran up the beach with it, holding it above our heads, and dropped it down at the foot of these shaly cliffs. And as we dropped it down, we realised that Moth had just run up the beach, holding a tent above his head. And only those weeks earlier, he'd been struggling to put his coat on without help. And he'd just run up that beach with that tent. And we realised then that something absolutely unbelievable was happening. He was seeing an improvement in his health that he'd been told was impossible. And in that moment there, on that beach, in the darkness, it just felt as if some sort of miracle was happening.
What's your explanation for that improvement, that change? What do you think caused it?
Well, at the time, we just didn't know. We just knew it was something to do with our time on the path. And now I don't actually know, but I've done so much research into what could be the reason for it. There are so many scientific papers that point to different reasons why his health might have improved as it did. There is research into things like Alzheimer's, which isn't the same, but in some respects it's connected to Moth's illness, where endurance training has brought back cognitive functions that appear to have been completely lost. So maybe something to do with the endurance element of it. I've had letters from doctors who say that currently there's quite a lot of belief in the idea that a very restricted diet can help neurological diseases. Well, we were on an incredibly restricted diet, but when they say restricted diet, I don't think they mean eating packet noodles and bags of fudge. I don't quite think that's what they have in mind. But then also I've done other research that shows how our bodies interact on a chemical level with chemicals that are emitted by plants. So time spent out in the natural environment, which we all know we need to do, maybe it's not just for our mental health. Maybe physically we actually need that. We actually still carry that almost primeval need for the wild, for nature, because we're still actually part of it. So lots of possibilities, but the actual answer still can't be pinned down, I think.
It also threw a light on homelessness. And interestingly, well, I found it interesting that it was only when you were forced to sleep overnight in an urban area that you actually felt really uncomfortable and almost in danger. But that actually gave you direct encounters with other homeless people. And the obvious thing that maybe people don't think about is that everyone has got their very individual situation about or set of reasons why they are homeless.
That's right. I mean, we didn't really understand anything about homelessness before we started that walk. It wasn't something I'd ever really encountered in my life. We lived in a very rural place. We just didn't see it, so hadn't really thought about it at all. So we certainly didn't think of how people would react to homelessness or that we would meet so many prejudices or preconceptions about what homeless people are. And actually, that incredible just assumption that people come to homelessness through their own fault, through probably mental health issues or substance abuse, and that really does seem to be the overriding belief of homelessness. But we met so many people that didn't fit that criteria, people that were living in sheds and horse boxes, people who were living as small communities of homeless people, just finding a way to go on. People who were working but couldn't afford to live in their community, in their area where they were working. And so it had to find another way of living. People living in communities of tented people in woodlands, or like I said, the horse boxes and the sheds. Or people living in their cars and people living under bridges. And we were really shocked to find that rural homelessness is as big an issue as urban homelessness. But strangely, sleeping wild in the environment, in the way we were, living wild, I suppose, we never felt afraid. We didn't feel any sense of fear until we found that we had to sleep in an urban area, where there were lots of people about and other homeless people. And then that sort of encroaching feeling of almost territorial space made us feel quite afraid, really. I think I came to realise then, during that time and during all those encounters with so many homeless people, that you cannot put just an assumption to those people that they are all individuals, and each of them come to homelessness through their own story and their own path. And if we're going to find a resolution to our homeless problem in this country, I think we've got to start at the very bottom and realise that those people aren't just numbers, they're not just statistics, they are all individual people with their own story, with their own life and their own needs. And we can't forget that every person we find on the street or in a shop doorway or under a hedgerow, they are individual people, just like me. They're people who've come to that with their own story.
By the time you got to the end of the Southwest Coastal Path, you ended up with somewhere to live very close to the path. I would imagine it would have been extremely difficult to settle down after that kind of moving about, which, reading your book, turned out to be the case. Would you mind reading that for us?
Winter passed. Spring came, then warmed into summer as I hid on the exposed cliff tops, hiding from other people, hiding from myself, where the sea was always in motion and the cry of the herring gulls on the wind unending. Midsummer, the sunset had moved beyond the west and was heading north as I crouched among the rocks near the cliff, watching the badgers scuffle out of their hole and head off into the undergrowth. The nights were so short now, the badgers needed to be out before darkness really came, or the sun would return before they had enough time to find food. It was too early in the year for ripe fruit, too late for birds' eggs. They needed all the time the short nights would allow to suck up the hundreds of worms and grubs they needed to eat each day. The sun had finally dipped below the horizon behind me, leaving the sky to the south, holding a mirror to the dying light. Pale turquoise blue, growing darker by the second, stretched from Bolt Head in the east to Lizard Point in the west, scattered with thin clouds that moments before had been low and white, but now were brightly lit in the reflections of pink. Torn ribbons of colour fluttering across the evening sky, a maypole dance of light. I followed the colours as they receded behind the land, back down into the village, to the darkness of the chapel, where Moth was writing up an assignment, and to another sleepless night.
She, just listening to you read that, you sound like a nocturnal animal. You sound like something that is, you know, that's trying to hide in the dark. You are, in your own words, hiding from the world. Why? Why are we hiding from the world? What was your overwhelming emotion at the time?
I thought it would be really easy to go back into normal life, to go back to living under a roof. It was what we wanted. We needed a home. We needed somewhere to be. And we found somewhere, and it should have been absolutely perfect, but I just couldn't settle. I felt agitated all the time. I couldn't sleep. It got so extreme that we put the tent up in the corner of the bedroom, and I slept in that for weeks. But I think the key to how I was feeling and why I was feeling that way came from that tent. When we opened that tent, it was as if I could smell the salt. I could smell the salt wind and feel the sea air. And I unrolled that sleeping bag and it was still full of the sand of the path. And I think the answer was in that, really. I'd spent my life in rural places. I'd grown up on a farm. Moth and I had lived in quite an isolated spot in Wales. And then we'd just come from months of living wild on those headlands. And I was now living in a village where I had never lived in a village before. I'd never had to go out of my front door and there would be people outside. It was that immediacy of having to connect with other people and almost a sense of claustrophobia, I think. It was something far more basic than that, and it took me a while to sort of pin down what it was. And I think when we were walking, we'd lost everything. We'd lost all our material possessions. We'd lost that sense of who we were in our own lives, never mind society. But that path had allowed us to re-find a strength, to re-find our connection to the natural world, that through my life on the farm, through our wild adventures in Scotland, had been at the core of who we were, and the core of our relationship was that connection to nature. And being there in the village, I think I felt as if I was so disconnected from that daily connection to the natural world, that I was losing touch with myself again, losing touch with who I was. And just withdrawing from other people, withdrawing from life, I think, almost.
Well, you ended up writing The Salt Path, and immediately it got snapped up by Penguin. And this led to another astonishing, so many, change, which has taken to you where you are now. Describe what happened.
Yeah, so the Salt Path was published, and I knew nothing whatsoever about publishing. I'd never written anything before. It was my first thing I'd ever written, so it was all very new to me. So when the publishers said, you've got to do PR now, and we want you to do social media as well, I was horrified. I didn't want to go and talk to other people about my book, and I had no idea what social media entailed at all. So I signed up to Twitter, having no idea what I was doing. And someone contacted me and said, I really want to talk to you. I've got something I want to tell you about. I gave him my phone number, you know, just as you do. Maybe wouldn't now, but seemed the obvious thing to do then. And this complete stranger rang me and said that he'd read The Salt Path. And he connected with our story on such a personal level that he felt he had to get in touch. And that he had an old historic cider farm just a few miles from where we were living in the village. And it had been neglected and really agriculturally overused and abused, really. But he had a dream that he would be able to bring the biodiversity back, bring the wildlife back to the farm and return it to what it should be, what it was, what it had always been in the past. And he'd read The Salt Path and really believed that we were the people to help him do that. And would we go and live at the farm and help him make it the place that he dreamt that it would be? Well, we just didn't know what to do. I mean, what do you do when you're faced with an offer like that? It seemed like everything we needed, you know, back on a farm, back into nature, back into wildlife. But how could we take that step? How could we actually ever trust anybody again enough to actually get involved in something like that? Because trust had led us down such, you know, strange avenues. It had led us to losing our house. And then with all the encounters with people who had treated us so strangely when we discovered we were homeless, trust seemed like such an elusive thing. We didn't know if we would ever dare to make that huge leap of faith that it would take to do that. But we came here one night to the farm, and just as it was dusk and we were about to leave, a deer jumped out of the hedgerow and just walked in front of the house and hesitated before disappearing into what then was like shoulder height weeds and grass. And there was just something so magical in that moment that we thought, you know, we've got to do this. We've absolutely just got to take the risk and do it. So we did. We just took a leap of faith and jumped, and here we are.
Well, would you mind reading again? Because you describe what the farm was like when you first went there, and it's a very different place, I'm sure, from how it is now.
What did we think? We couldn't think, but sat in the sunburnt grass. There was a silence in the air, no bird calls or insects buzzing. Not even the gentle rustle of the seed heads of grass moving in the wind. Just a hot, still, wild silence. The silence of an empty land where no wild things lived. Below us, lambs were penned under the apple trees, confined by metal hurdles into a corral of dry earth. The grass eaten away to stone and tree roots. Fleeces brown with dry soil, they scratched at the fence, hungry, waiting for food to come. The buzzard had circled the hill and appeared out of the sky behind us, weaving his way down the valley, his long, plaintive call filling the empty, silent landscape. What did we think? Do you mean you want to rewild the farm?
So you have gone about that. Can you tell us about the farm now and what you've done?
Well, it really was a silent place when we came. There was hardly any wildlife here, a few squabbling sparrows and a couple of crows that lived in the tree by the house, but hardly any insect life, nothing, and an orchard that had been neglected very badly over many years. And it's not really been about what we've done here. I think it's been about what we haven't done. The land here had had quite heavy agricultural use, so overgrazed, overstocked, and a lot of chemical inputs. Well, we've cut the chemical inputs right back to absolute bare necessity. Much, much lighter grazing. and started to regenerate the orchards and regenerate the grasslands in such a way that allows the grasslands to mature, to the seeds to mature and fall. And with that, in just the 2 years that we've been here, the wildlife has started to return, the biodiversity has started to return, the very basic line of the food chain has come back. We've seen insects here that certainly weren't here before, and clouds of gatekeeper butterflies, clouds of pollinators that have come here, bees and so many other pollinators that weren't here before. And with that has come so much bird life that we couldn't imagine would be possible for it to return in such a short time. There have been yellowhammers and long-tailed tits and all sorts of wildlife. Curlews have come here to feed in the meadows from the creek below. And then the raptors have moved in. And in the last few weeks, we've had a barn owl has moved into the cider barn. And when the raptors come, you know the whole food chain is there. You know that the whole system is building itself back to where it should be. And in such a short period of time, it's been... We hoped it might happen, but it's been a real surprise to find that it is actually possible.
And with all those changes, presumably the wild is no longer silent. You know, you walk out of a summer's evening or even at this time of year, what do you hear?
Birds. Birds of every kind all the time. And in the summer, buzzing of insects. And the air definitely isn't silent anymore, that's for sure. And the deer are here and other wildlife that pass through on a daily basis. And it's been remarkable to see it, and definitely not silent anymore.
When you did the Southwest Coastal Path, it helped moths' condition enormously, but obviously it didn't cure moths' condition. You know, and across the period, you know, where you are now, he continued to sort of slightly slide back downhill again, and you decided what you needed was another expedition, you know, to get back out, to reconnect. Not the Southwest Coastal Path this time, but Iceland. Why Iceland?
Why Iceland? Yeah, why Iceland? I don't know. It was a strange thing. When Moth stopped walking and he started studying for his degree, then it was a very sedentary thing. And as he stopped walking, his health started to decline really quickly. We knew we needed to be back in nature, being active in the wild and coming to the farm. It's definitely helped his health. It definitely helped in that he's found a sort of plateau with his health. And at the moment, it's not deteriorating too quickly. But he really felt as if he wanted to see if another long walk would sort of push his health to improve in the way it did before. And we had this book, it was called Epic Hikes, and it had this fantastic picture of these real incredible mountains, incredibly multicoloured mountains. And I kept leaving it open on the table or on the bed. And unexpectedly, a few weeks later, Moth said, I'd really like to go to Iceland. We left this country in a heat wave. It was absolutely in the 30s, boiling hot. And we arrived in Iceland at what turned out to be the very end of their summer and the very start of winter.
You wrote about what you actually learnt from that trip.
We did. We learnt so much from that trip, not just about ourselves, but also, I think, about everything else that I've been trying to talk about in the wild silence, about that sense of the natural world not actually needing us, that the natural world can go on without us. I think that walk was like a walk through evolution. It was a walk from where the earth had sort of destroyed itself right through to where it had rebuilt itself. And I thought that whole walk tied into everything else that I was trying to say in Wild Silence. The black ash of the valley behind us, we re-entered the multicoloured hills. The sun still bright in the late afternoon, highlighting their colours with even greater brilliance. The path levelled at last and we walked parallel to an ice-capped mountain, the frozen wind keeping us in waterproofs despite the sunshine. And all around, the earth continued to breathe out plumes of sulphur which rose from the blues and greens that surrounded the vent holes. Two sheep walked slowly past a steam cloud. There were very few sheep in the Southern Highlands, despite there being more than twice as many sheep on Iceland as there are humans. There's nothing to attract them up here, just an occasional ribbon of green on a distant hillside. Yet intermittently they appeared in twos and threes, small family groups. A harsh and difficult life, trekking miles between sources of food and water. But here in the Highlands, they are free to be their unfettered, wild selves, the wild animals they really are. We carried on, touched by the sight of the only animals we'd encountered for 2 days. No animals or birds, no insects, no life other than humans. This vast, barren landscape wasn't a place for life. But as we walked through it, silent, each in our own state of wonder, I felt closer to my real self than I had since leaving the tent for the last time on the Southwest Coast Path. Only the land breathed here, and I breathed with it.
So it's clear for you that your deep connection to nature is intrinsic to your identity. Through adversity and everything, it's been transformational for you actually recognising that, and also for Moth's health as well. You're obviously writing about this, but is it a mission of yours to share what you've learnt?
I think, I don't know about a mission, but I think when you've learnt something, it's worth passing it on, isn't it? I think the natural world has always been so important in our lives. It's been such an important feature. And then we've witnessed how Moth's health improved when we were walking, when he was actually out in his natural state, you know? We're built to walk. We're built to be part of the environment. We are part of the environment. And to see that putting him back into that state, his health improved, has almost been a parallel with what's happening here on the farm. By taking the human input out of the land, then it's allowed the farm to return more to its natural state, more to its wild state. And its health has improved by that happening. And I think there's something to be learnt from that we are part of the natural world. We're not observers of it. We're not outside of it. We are part of it. And what happens to the natural world is going to inevitably happen to us. And We have to learn from everything that we can in order to give ourselves the best hope of a future that we can have. Well, it's hard for any of us now to doubt that climate change is occurring. And we all, there is no denying the loss of biodiversity that's happening across our country, across the world. So if there's any ways in which we can find a way forwards, a way that we can all continue to exist and enjoy this incredible planet, then I think anything that can be said about that, you know, really needs to be said about it. In the same way as when we were homeless, we knew nothing about that, but we learned so much while we were walking. And I feel I now have a responsibility to talk about homelessness because it's something I learned so much about that I feel I've got to go on and write about it and talk about it. And I think if we don't spread the things we learn, then human experience, what is it? What's it for?
Would you throw up your hands in horror if I were to use the term sympathetic magic? You know, by doing good, by meaning good, by having good intentions, some of that kind of shines back on you?
Well, I've never heard of that one. That's quite a nice idea, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. So it was just an idea. And I have to ask this question because, I mean, people who have read the books, probably like me, kind of feel that they know him. How is Moth nowadays?
I mean, he's not as well as he was when we finished walking. But we did find when we were in Iceland that his health started to improve again. It did start to improve as we were on that really quite difficult walk, although nowhere near as long as the Southwest Coast Path. I mean, his health's not as well as it was at that point, but it's still so much better. He's still so much better than the doctors and the consultants say he should be. So we just keep doing what we do and keep hoping.
And just out of curiosity, have the consultants said anything about the fact that he's kind of kicking the trend, that he's not behaving the way he ought to be behaving according to their predictions?
Yes, they still don't know why, and they still don't know how. But as they say, the human body is a remarkable thing and it keeps showing us new things all the time. So basically their advice now is to keep doing what you're doing, but still be careful on the stairs.
Ray, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Rena Wynn's books, The Salt Path and The Wild Silence, are published by Penguin. And I think it's fair to say, Helen, they come very highly recommended by both of us.
Absolutely, yeah. You'll find yourself, as I did, even in the middle of the night reading. Just keeping going with it, you're not wanting to put it down.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful read and there's a lot to learn in there. For myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham and Rainer Wynn, thank you very much for listening to this.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.